From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! A Virginia death row inmate is executed despite an international outcry to save his life. It was the Democrats' turn to draw blood in the campaign finance hearings in the Senate. We'll hear some highlights. And the president-elect of the American Public Health Association gives his views on Medicare means testing. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Julie Drizin, sitting in for Amy Goodman. Neither Mother Teresa nor Pope John Paul could save the life of Joseph Roger O'Dell, who went to the death chamber last night, put to death by the state of Virginia for the 1985 rape and murder of a secretary. With syringes in both arms and leather belts binding him to a gurney Wednesday night, O'Dell said in a loud, clear voice, "Governor Allen, you're killing an innocent man." With death only moments away, O'Dell said he had lived the happiest day of his life because he got married to his wife, law student Lori Ures, who launched an international campaign to save his life. We'll be talking about that case and the state of the death penalty in America later in today's program. Andrew Cunanan, the suspected serial killer who eluded a nationwide manhunt for nearly 3 months, shot himself to death in a houseboat just 2.5 miles from the spot where Johnny Versace was gunned down. More than 100 police and FBI agents surrounded the floating two-story home after a report of a gunshot came from inside. Republicans are promising to work to pick up the pieces after a session filled with emotion, filled with passion, at which top lieutenants to Newt Gingrich begged forgiveness for their actions in a foiled coup attempt. The apologies of the three leaders, Majority Leader Dick Armey, Democratic Whip Tom DeLay, and GOP Conference Chairman John Boehner, helped save their jobs as Gingrich pronounced the palace intrigue a closed matter. Republican leaders had hoped a carefully orchestrated show of support and the vow to focus on the future would help them overcome the embarrassing incident which has distracted the Capitol for the past week. The Pentagon now says that nearly 100,000 U.S. troops were exposed to trace amounts of poison gas from exploded Iraqi weapons shortly after the Gulf War, but that none received doses high enough to cause noticeable health effects, even though the estimate of troops exposed is 5 times the Pentagon's earlier guess. It is sticking to its views that the chemical release on March 10, 1991 appears unrelated to the mysterious illnesses reported by Gulf veterans. The dominoes are starting to fall at General Motors. A day after a strike began at a major parts plant near Detroit, the giant automaker told workers not to report for this morning's early shift at a Buick plant in Flint, Michigan. And a GM source says another assembly plant in Michigan could be shut down before the day is out. The shutdowns are being forced by shortages caused by a strike involving 2,800 unionized workers at GM's Powertrain Group plant in Warren, Michigan. That plant makes transmissions, wheels, and suspension parts. Talks to resolve the walkout ended just before midnight and are to resume this morning. Meanwhile, in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, hundreds of landless farm workers are occupying the site of a future General Motors Corp plant. In southern Brazil, one farm worker said the group is demanding government loans equal to 5% of the $234 million the state granted GM in tax incentives. And there is a general strike underway in Israel today. Israeli unions launched a nationwide wildcat strike to support communication workers battling privatization moves. Particularly hurt is Tel Aviv's Ben Gurion International Airport. And those are some of the top stories in the news at this hour. And you're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Julie Drizin, sitting in for Amy Goodman, who could not be with us today because her grandmother passed away late last night. We send our condolences out to her and the Goodman family. All this week, the Democrats have had their chance to draw blood at the Senate campaign finance abuse hearings. The first day of these hearings, in which the Democrats have finally had their day in court, had two witnesses, Michael Baruti, the former head of a conservative Republican think tank called the National Policy Forum. Before Baruti, though, was an attorney representing a millionaire donor to the National Policy Forum, Benton Becker. The Democrats have sweated out two long weeks waiting for their turn to prove that both sides of the aisle are taking in millions and millions in campaign donations. And all week on Democracy Now!, we've been bringing you some highlights from these events. Yesterday's focus was on this National Policy Forum, which is effectively an arm of the Republican Party, and the fundraising activities engaged there. Here are some highlights from yesterday's hearing. Michael Baruti.
It is by now well known in the common parlance of this committee, perhaps it is old news, that NPF's chairman and I disagreed about the appropriate funding and operation of the NPF, and that to me, our disagreements were significant, so much so that when I found I could not prevail, I felt compelled to resign. Going to NPF and leaving it were not easy decisions. But as followers of these proceedings also know, our disagreements accumulated to what I titled Some Reasons for Resignation in a memo I wrote to be confidential and always kept so. It does not in any way minimize the importance of those disagreements to say that they do not rise to the same significance as do other matters before this committee. For example, whether a foreign government planned to interfere in American politics or whether the national security of the United States of America was compromised in the last election. Second, the disagreements between the chairman and me were many, but they boil down to two I think especially relevant to this committee's inquiry. One, I thought using foreign money to fund NPF would be wrong. And two, I thought the lines between NPF and RNC were not sharply enough drawn and made separation between the two seem a fiction, though separation was required by our application for tax-exempt status. On the first point, Mr. Chairman, I believe my exact words to NPF's chairman upon first hearing from him the foreign funding idea were these. We could get the money all right. That would be easy, but it would be wrong. I did not mean with that allusion that it would be illegal. If I had meant illegal, I would have said, and later written, illegal. But I understood at the time and was later reassured by counsel that an entity organized under Section 501(c)(4) of the Federal Tax Code was legally permitted to receive foreign contributions. I said it would be wrong, meaning not right, inappropriate, unseemly, and imprudent, because I did not think an organization so inherently involved in American money, so inherently involved in American political public policy processes should be funded with other than American money. I also believed that foreign funding would inevitably become public and controversial, as in fact it has, and that such controversy would draw attention away from and cast doubts on the legitimacy of what I hoped would be a substantial contribution by the NPF to American political discourse and to a reasserted primacy of the Republican Party as the party of ideas. As to the second point of disagreement, the fiction of separation between the RNC and the NPF, this too was troubling. I came to believe that the NPF was being operated in a way that risked denial of its C-4 application by the IRS, as eventually occurred. Again, I did not think we were acting illegally. I did think we were putting the C-4 application in jeopardy. I had this concern essentially for two reasons. First, the advice of counsel, who had analogized NPF and its application for tax-exempt status to a rowboat. Every questionable action taken by NPF, she said, was like throwing a pebble in the boat, and too many pebbles would sink the NPF, or at least sink its C4 application. In this view, the risk came not just if we crossed certain legal bright lines and operated NPF in clearly prohibited ways. Certainly, that would have jeopardized the application, but it didn't happen while I was there. The NPF simply did not engage in electioneering or campaigns or campaign fundraising. Rather, Council's stronger caution was against NPF too often even approaching that legal bright line. The repeated exercise of questionable judgment, she warned, the accumulation of too many such misjudgments, the piling up, if you will, of pebbles in the boat, could itself be sufficient to sink the application. Accordingly, I thought prudence dictated that we at NPF act like close personal friends of Caesar's wife. That is, NPF had to be unassailably pure and, of course, unambiguously separate from the RNC.
The voice of Michael Baruti, the former head of the National Policy Forum here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! That's an excerpt from yesterday's hearing in the Senate on campaign finance abuses. Baruti, to tell you a little bit about him, he was a man who worked on the Goldwater campaign early in his career, later for the Ford and Dole run in 76 and throughout the 80s for Reagan and Bush White House. He's the... Michael Baruti was involved in the National Policy Forum, and as he describes it, the NPF was to be a grassroots forum for developing ideas, not a party fundraising machine, not a vehicle for getting out the vote, but a group that would, quote, listen to Americans. And it started with a $100,000 loan from the Republican National Committee. They went around the country. They had 62 public meetings, and eventually Baruti resigned after a year at the NPF. He was disillusioned with what he called, quote, the fiction separating the two organizations. That's the NPF and the RNC, the Republican National Committee. And he was worried that NPF's status as a nonprofit or a 501c4 would be taken away. Now, after Baruti stepped down from the National Policy Forum, Haley Barbour went ahead with a plan he'd talked about for a few years, bailing out the NPF with a loan of foreign money. And this is where foreign money fits in. While he was at the NPF, Michael Baruti always rejected that idea, saying that an American think tank should be funded with American money, whatever that is. But Barbour went ahead and had Richard Richards approach the Taiwanese millionaire Ambrose Young. He got $2 million loan from Ambrose Young. Benton Becker, who was Young's American attorney, oversaw the entire deal. Barbour arranged for the loan, saying the RNC would pay off any of the $2 million debt if the NPF defaulted. And here is Benton Becker.
Mr. Young and I felt it important that if Mr. Young's corporation was to agree to collateralize such a substantial loan, that collateral must be secured. I consulted Dick Richards on this matter, who agreed. He also noted his experience with the Republican Party was that the RNC was capable of raising substantial funds. We were all of the opinion that the RNC should serve as a form of safety net or guarantor to Mr. Young's company, as had been previously assured to Mr. Young in papers Mr. Barbour caused to be delivered to Mr. Young. I discussed my concerns with Mr. David Norcross, the general counsel of the RNC, and also the general counsel of the National Policy Forum. The result of those conversations was a letter written to me by Mr. Barbour, dated August 30, 1994, wherein Mr. Barbour wrote, and I quote, "Because NPF, that's National Policy Forum, is separate from the Republican National Committee, the RNC is not automatically responsible for its debt. Nevertheless, I am committed to making sure NPF raises sufficient funds to cover its operation and pay off any and all its debts. Moreover, as chairman of the RNC, in the event NPF defaults on any debt, I will ask the Republican National Committee to authorize me to guarantee and pay off any NPF debt. I am confident the RNC would grant me such authority at its next meeting, providing there is a valid and outstanding debt of the NPF to a U.S. bank or other lending institution guaranteed by a U.S. citizen or domestic corporation," end of quote. Heartened by this assurance, Mr. Young and I still did not believe we knew enough about the National Policy Forum, which had been previously described to us as a tax-exempt, non-political think tank that was to be the recipient of the bank loan guaranteed by YBD USA with funds borrowed from its parent corporation in Hong Kong. I attempted to ascertain the financial condition of the National Policy Forum. I contacted a Mr. Bolton, the president of the National Policy Forum, who provided me with information including fundraising results of the National Policy Forum and a breakdown of National Policy Forum pledges in place on a month-to-month basis. Based on what I saw, although approximately $2 million in debt to the RNC at the time, the National Policy Forum appeared to be taking in significant contributions, mostly from well-respected Fortune 500 companies. Given the RNC commitment to seek authorization to pay off the MPF debt in the event of an MPF default, Mr. Richards' advice that no RNC chairman would be refused such a request by the RNC, my personal experience with the integrity of past RNC chairpersons, and independent counsel's opinion of the propriety of the loan guarantee, Mr. Young was more comfortable with moving forward with the loan guarantee. Mr. Young agreed to a loan guarantee for the National Policy Forum through Young Brothers USA in the amount of $2.1 million. Working with Mr. Norcross and others at the lending bank, the Signet Bank, the bank originated a loan, a loan guarantee was structured whereby YBD USA purchased 11 $190,000 certificates of deposit at the Signet Bank in Washington with funds wired from its parent corporation. Those certificates of deposit were the collateral for the MPF loan. It was structured that the MPF would make quarterly payments over the course of 3 years and that each payment, now with each payment, a certificate of deposit would be released and the funds wired back directly to the Hong Kong parent. I was told by officers of MPF and by Mr. Norcoff that the MPFs expected the loan to be paid off on an accelerated basis and that the YBD USA collateral would be released early. All of the money used by YBD USA to purchase the certificates of deposit for collateral came in the form of a loan from its parent corporation in Hong Kong. Young Brothers Development USA had at the time and continues at the present time to have no significant assets or income.
And that's the voice of Benton Becker, who is the American attorney for Ambrose Young, a Taiwanese millionaire who funneled some money into the National Policy Forum, which is linked with the Republican National Committee. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Julie Drizin, sitting in for Amy Goodman. Today, our reporter Fuff Vollmeyer will be up on the Hill, as will Don Rush, covering today's hearings in the Senate Governmental Affairs Committee. And today's hearings feature Haley Barbour, the former chairman for the National Policy Forum, and Fred Volkoncek, who is a former consultant for the NPF, and they'll be taking some questions from the Senate Governmental Affairs panel. What do you think of all of this campaign finance abuse hearings that are happening in the Senate? You know, not too many folks in the press are covering it. We are there every day. Is it worth it to you? Are you able to follow what's going on? Do you care? Many people in this country think that Americans don't care. And perhaps the way the hearings are structured, it's to get you not to care. Let us know what you think. Call our listener comment line at 202-588-0999, extension 313. Let us know what you think about the campaign finance scandal and the hearings. Are you interested in continued coverage here on Democracy Now! Coming up, a look at death penalty American style in 60 seconds.
Thank you.
And this is Democracy Now! I'm Julie Drizin, sitting in for Amy Goodman. And now we turn our attention to another subject, and that is the death penalty in the United States. Despite an international outcry, Virginia state officials last night executed Joseph O'Dell. Earlier in the day, Virginia Governor George Allen rejected worldwide pleas for clemency, including appeals by the Pope, the Italian government, Mother Teresa, and Lori Ures, who is an American law student who has been fighting on Joe O'Dell's behalf for many years and married him yesterday in a last-minute ceremony before his death by lethal injection. I'm joined now by Stephen Hawkins, who's the executive director of the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. Welcome to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Thank you for having me, Julie.
Steve, so what is this number what this year? How many people have been executed by the state so far this year?
Joseph O'Dell makes the 44th person to be executed this year in the United States.
How does that compare to previous years since, 1976 when the Supreme Court reinstated the death penalty?
Well, we're on a record. The next execution will tie last year. We'll probably tie the record since 1976 by October. We're going to execute more people in this country than any time since the reinstatement of the death penalty. Yet, as we see in Joseph O'Dell's case, all of the safeguards that are supposed to be in place are breaking down.
Tell me about Joseph O'Dell. Who was he, and what was he convicted of?
Joseph O'Dell was convicted of killing a Virginia Beach woman back in 1986. The evidence against him, the primary evidence, were two blood stains, one on his shirt, one on his jacket, and a confession from a jailhouse informant that said that, or a statement from a jailhouse informant that Joseph O'Dell had confessed the murder to him. But by 1990, the blood stain evidence, through the DNA testing that was available then, ruled out one of the blood stains completely, and a federal district court judge found the other one to be inconclusive. Last October, the informant admitted that he lied on the witness stand, and so all of the evidence that put Joseph O'Dell in prison, that the governor says established in his mind that the jury got it right, all of that evidence was thrown into serious doubt by last October.
And Joseph O'Dell was a man who had committed crimes before. That's why he was targeted.
Precisely. He had a criminal record. The police knew of his presence in the area at that night, and they basically built their case around him.
What about the use of jailhouse informers against inmates? That seems to happen quite a lot, that somebody on the inside seems to say so-and-so admitted that they did it, and that sort of reinforces death penalty.
Yes. It is extremely typical, and we have seen it again and again and again in death penalty cases where someone who is awaiting trial somehow, for some strange reason, makes this confession to a complete stranger in the cell next to them. And of course, these are informants who obviously are getting deals cut on their sentences in exchange for cooperation. And there have been a number of cases now where these informants have come forward and admitted that they lied on the witness stand. Walter McMillan spent 10 years on death row in Alabama, now a free man, sent there by one of these informants' testimony.
Tell me what your involvement in the O'Dell case was like.
Well, ours started last year at this time when Lori Ures asked for us to help her get the word out internationally about Joseph O'Dell's case. We helped to put her in contact with members of the Italian government and citizens who we knew would be very concerned, and that helped to build the international support for him. What, of course, troubled us very much in Joseph O'Dell's case was very, very strong evidence of his innocence. There have been 69 people released in this country in the last 20 years who have been found to be innocent, not released because of legal technicalities, but released because there was evidence that resulted in a judge dismissing the case against them and in many of those instances, the state not even trying to seek to recharge them. And Joseph O'Dell is one of those examples. You know, people say, well, can you prove that someone innocent has been executed? Of course, terribly difficult to prove, but Joseph O'Dell is an example of justice American style right now.
Now, you said that you helped Laura Ewers get in touch with Italian activists who rallied around Joseph O'Dell, as they have on other death row cases. I know that in Europe there's a lot of interest in the Mumia Abu-Jamal case. What is it about Italy that they're so interested in O'Dell and the death penalty in this country?
Well, in general, the Italian citizens, from our experience, are the most committed and most passionately against the death penalty, and just not the elites, but also just your average citizen in Italy has shown tremendous concern. In cases where I have represented death row inmates, I have gotten calls from Italian citizens expressing their concern to the very end. And they took a particular interest in Joseph O'Dell's case because they were shocked and dismayed that there could be questions unresolved about guilt, innocence, something that fundamental, and the courts and the governor being so callous in their regard.
It seems that with where science is right now, DNA testing is the main tool that can be used to ultimately prove guilt or innocence in a lot of these cases. Why was the state resistant to actually going through and finally, you know, employing more science in this case before they finally put O'Dell to death?
I think the state was resistant because they were afraid what would come out. The one blood stain had already been found to be totally disreputed. The second one was ruled to be inconclusive, and what was left was a semen sample that had been preserved that could have been tested with DNA technology that wasn't available in 1990, but is available now, and it would have, and still could, be very conclusive as to whether Joseph O'Dell was the rapist and murderer in this case, and they simply refused to have that testing done.
So, last night, Joseph O'Dell was executed, and one of the things that's so curious to me is that there is a role for the medical establishment in these executions. There's usually, a doctor present who declares him dead or administers the...
The medical profession and a number of medical groups have spoken out against any role of physicians being involved in executions. Physicians for Human Rights has made very strong statements, as have other organizations. The American Medical Association, from what I understand, discourages doctors from any participation. Uh-huh. But yes, I was at the prison last night when they carted away Joseph O'Dell's body in a black van shortly after the execution, and they were taking him to the medical examiner's office to have an autopsy done to determine his cause of death.
Big surprise. And
exactly.
And what do they determine is his cause of death? Don't they write down homicide on it or state sponsored?
They actually do. I mean, the official reason is homicide. It is a.
But, you know, it could be, the official reason could be that he committed the crime in a wrong state or guilt, you know, he was executed by politicians. One of the things that's amazing to me is that apart from whether or not O'Dell was guilty or innocent, same person committing a similar crime in a different state might meet a different fate. And one of the problems with the death penalty in this country is that there isn't an equality of who gets executed for what crimes.
That is quite right. as we see the death penalty used in the United States, it is completely arbitrary, absolutely completely arbitrary in its application, depending upon which state you're in, which jurisdiction you're in, can determine very much life or death.
And of course, the race of the victim.
Race of the victim, your class background plays an enormous amount. Joseph O'Dell was poor working class. We have never, ever, ever had a person of wealth end up on death row in this country. And
we probably never will.
And we probably never will, exactly.
Steve Hawkins is the executive director of the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. He's with us this morning on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! So tell me what happened. Lori Ewers came to you and said, we want to do some organizing around the Joseph O'Dell case. What do you do next?
What we do next is help someone like Lori really begin to put together the pieces of a campaign that will gather and garner attention. Certainly all of the credit goes to Lori for having the tenacity to really work.
Global effort gets organized.
Well, our organization, the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, we have a network now of persons throughout Europe who are terribly concerned about how the death penalty is being administered in the United States. Just this morning, I was checking my voicemail on the way here, and I had a call from Italy. I had a call from the United Kingdom. Yesterday, we had interviews with French and German radio and television. So everyone in Europe is tremendously concerned about and tremendously shocked at how the United States is able to carry out this punishment, portray itself as the protector of human rights in the world, yet be willing to allow someone to be executed when there are still grave doubt about something as fundamental as their guilt or innocence.
I was asking about the presence of doctors earlier because I was thinking about how ironic it is in this country that the Supreme Court is taking up the issue of physician-assisted suicide, and with an allegedly willing person who wants to end their life, physicians are not allowed to help that person, but physicians actually get involved in state-sponsored execution, and something seems a little bit ironic about.
Mm-hmm. It is terribly ironic that the Supreme Court's position is, we won't allow anyone to help you kill yourself, including a medical doctor, but we have no problems killing you ourselves. We have no problems involving the medical profession in carrying out executions in this country. And that is very shocking, and it still goes against certainly the Hippocratic Oath of doing no harm. And these are, of course, persons who want to live.
Right. In some cases.
Yes.
So tell me what the scene was like last night in Virginia. You said that you were outside where the O'Dell execution was taking place.
Yes. The scene was, we were put in a field a fair distance from the prison and kept away from the press. We were not in the main sort of perimeter where the press was, so the press had to come back through the guard post, come out and interview the protesters, go back in.
And who was there? Protesters, primarily religious people, Helen Prejean?
Helen Prejean was inside the prison as serving as Joseph's spiritual advisor. But members of our organization, members of our local affiliate, the Virginian Coalition for Alternatives to the Death Penalty, were out last night. No one was there to advocate for the execution, which is
That's unusual, isn't it?
Well, it is, and And it isn't. I think now we are reaching a point in this country where the death penalty is tragically sort of becoming passé. I mean, the people who want it really aren't out beating their chest and any longer attending executions. The state goes about killing people, killing citizens with very few people really paying close attention.
You know, there was a lawsuit recently in California. A television station, public television station, was suing to try to get the rights to televise California execution. I think it was the California's first execution, Robert Alton Harris, a couple of years ago. What do you think? I mean, it is a barbaric thought and sight for Americans to witness this, even though they witness, you know, dead bodies, bludgeoned bodies, and lots of, you know, simulated violence on television all the time, but state-sponsored violence. What do you think about the idea of televised executions?
I think that televised executions, it is very much a sort of raging debate within the movement to abolish the death penalty, because on one hand, certainly people who are opposed to the death penalty, or who may have some strong ambivalence towards it, would be perhaps moved by the disgust from seeing an execution to get involved. Yet, of course, there's also the concern, though, that it would become a staged event where I could see, you know, bars across this country having discount beer specials to in and pack in, and I mean, and we've seen that
kind of.
Just
see the logos on television coming up.
The logos, you could imagine.
Death at midnight, you know, whatever.
People buying to have a commercial space for advertisements because
I could even see gambling. Gambling. How long did it take for this individual to die? People will be placing bets. So it could become an American phenomenon in that sense, an American public phenomenon, like everything else. On the other hand, it could encourage people to, it could help people recognize the collective responsibility here, that here is someone who is being killed in everybody's name by the state.
Well, also, what could be very powerful for television, for media in general, is to be able to really spend some time getting to know someone who is going to be executed, being with that person, following them, let's say, through their last 14 days or last month of their lives. Very little documentary work has been done like that. Now, understand, in Virginia now, the press cannot interview a death row inmate, cannot have any kind of contact. So when we talk about the support that grew for Joseph Odell, that became the only way for anyone to know of his existence, because the press was completely cut off.
And the press is being increasingly cut off in states around the country. We have just a moment left, and I wanted to ask you, what's up next on the death penalty front? Are there individuals who've gotten their death warrants and the dates scheduled that we should be looking out for?
There are a number of people in August who are scheduled. There are some innocent persons like Kyle's down in Louisiana who has gone back for retrial. So there are cases that we should be very careful and concerned about.
And in August, where are the other cases?
A number in Texas.
Big surprise there.
Yeah. The next person to be executed is Bobby West in Texas next week.
Thanks so much for joining us, Stephen Hawkins, the Executive Director of the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, whose webpage is www.ncadp.org. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be talking about the disparity in crack cocaine sentencing after this short break.
I'm alone. So many memories playing over and over. Oh, yeah. I can still.
This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Julie Drizin, sitting in for Amy Goodman today. Amy couldn't be here today because her grandmother died last night. We send out our best wishes to the Goodman family. A proposal to narrow the differences in prison sentences for people caught selling crack and powdered cocaine is meeting resistance from members of both political parties on Capitol Hill. Current law sets the same mandatory 5-year penalties for selling 5 grams of crack or 500 grams of powdered cocaine. It's called the 100-to-1 ratio. And if you can visualize it, maybe 5 grams of crack would take up a packet or a few packets of Sweet and Low or Equal, whereas 500 grams of powdered cocaine might fill an entire Arm & Hammer baking soda container. So that's the difference in the amount. This week, the White House announced that it planned to reduce the ratio from 100 to 1 to 10 to 1 by imposing the same 5-year penalty on the sales of 25 grams of crack or 10 times as much powdered cocaine, 250 grams. And this is a proposal that Attorney General Janet Reno is supporting. However, it's causing a big ruckus on Capitol Hill. Some Republican lawmakers, like Spencer Abraham, a Republican of Michigan, who's also a member of the Judiciary Committee, said the proposal wasn't the way to go because of an increase in teenage drug use and that it sends the wrong signal to young people. However, by the way, Senator Barry McCaffrey, the drug czar, does support this change. However, members of the Congressional Black Caucus yesterday held quite an angry press conference on Capitol Hill denouncing this change, saying that it was not complete justice. Members of the Congressional Black Caucus for years have been pushing for fairness in crack cocaine sentences. We've been seeing an explosion of the prison population, primarily among young African American men who get mandatory minimums for selling a very minimal amount of crack, whereas a lot of folks who sell cocaine don't even make it behind bars, and it's considered a vast racial disparity. And this is being addressed at a time when President Clinton, of course, is trying to lead a national discussion on race. We now go to tape that we have courtesy of Verna Avery Bound, Pacifica Network news anchor. Here's from the Congressional Black Caucus press conference yesterday, beginning with Jesse Jackson Jr., followed by Maxine Waters.
But I am honored to be here today. And sentencing disparity relative to crack and powder cocaine, from my perspective, is part of the race dialogue that the president says he wants to have. He wants candor on the race dialogue. So here it is. The facts are astounding, disturbing, and outrageous. In 1980, of every 1,000 persons arrested on drug charges, 19 went to prison. In 1992, the numbers were 104 to 1,000. In 1993, the nation's prison system grew at a rate of 1,200 inmates per week. That same pattern exists today. Between 1982 and 1992, long before I got to Congress, state governments built 455 new prisons. 60% of those in prison are black, while blacks are only 12% of the population. 91% of those serving a 5-year mandatory sentence for possession of crack cocaine are African American, yet 55% of all crack cocaine users are white. 2 years ago, the Los Angeles Times reported in an article entitled "War on Crack Targets Minorities Over Whites," that despite evidence that large numbers of whites use and sell crack cocaine, federal law enforcement in Southern California has waged its war against crack almost exclusively in minority neighborhoods, exposing black and Latino offenders to the toughest drug penalties in the nation. Not a single white, records showed at the time, had been convicted of a crack cocaine offense in federal courts serving Los Angeles and 6 Southland counties since Congress enacted stiff mandatory sentences for crack dealers in 1986. It stated that no whites were federally prosecuted in 17 states and many cities, including Boston, Denver, Chicago, Miami, Dallas, and Los Angeles. Well, what is my point? First, the president should have begun his negotiations with Republicans on this issue with a ratio of 1 to 1. Mm-hmm. which would be equal justice, not begin with an unjust 10-to-1 ratio to replace an even more unjust ratio of 100-to-1. Mm-hmm. Secondly, I do not support possession, the distribution, or the use of illegal drugs of any kind. On the other hand, I do support equal protection of the laws. And those being caught with one type of drug, crack cocaine, should not be given a disproportionate prison sentence over those caught with similar illegal drugs. They should not be tried in different courts, resulting in uneven sentences for the same offense. In my judgment, the uneven incarceration of those caught with crack cocaine is a deliberate attempt to fill jails with young black youth. And I want to make it very, very clear that when the president announced his race dialogue, I always felt from the very beginning that it would be part of a Republican strategy to limit the president's race dialogue to one subject, affirmative action. And that's why Ward Connerly showed up at the race dialogue and began spinning the president's speech in a direction that would limit a one-year conversation on the nation's 378-year-old problem to just one subject, affirmative action. But there are many subjects that have to be addressed when we consider the profundity and the nature that race has played in the development of our country and understanding America, and this is also one of them. Mm-hmm. And so, if you enter into a negotiation, we should ask for the whole thing, 1-to-1, mm-hmm. equal protection under the law. Mm-hmm. Don't come to the negotiation, Mr. President, with a 10-to-1 ratio when it's clearly unfair and unjust. It means that Republicans will simply say, instead of 100-to-1 ratio, which we presently have, and the 1-to-1 ratio, which is equal protection under the law, let's start at 10, and therefore they'll say, okay, we'll cut a deal at around 50-to-1. That's not a successful or an effective negotiation, and needless to say, I'm a little bit disappointed. Thank you very much.
Let me just say that what you have witnessed is a strong voice from the Congressional Black Caucus. We convened the press some time ago, and we gave you our agenda. And we told you that the eradication of drugs was number one on our agenda. And we listed the other agenda items that we thought were doable. We have chased this administration. We have gone to every appropriations hearing. We have done everything in our power to support a drug budget that will eradicate drugs and get some programs going in our communities, get some actions in our community that will get rid of drugs. We're serious about this. We have chased the drug czar. We have chased the president. When we met with the president, we said that our number one effort, the Black Caucus agenda, was getting rid of drugs. We have discussed this drug issue in two ways. We talked about no more just say no, Nancy Reagan-type public relations programs. We want to do something real. Our communities are devastated by drugs. We also said to the president, when we work on this drug issue, we've got to make sense out of it, and we've got to have fairness. We talked about some time ago this great disparity in sentencing, the mandatory minimum sentencing, where the Justice Department targets black communities, minority communities, and they arrest small-time drug dealers and those who are addicted, selling small amounts of crack cocaine, and they target them and they send them straight to the federal system where they get mandatory minimum sentencing of 5 years for 5 grams of crack cocaine. At the same time, right next door, even in the same community, you can arrest someone, and most of the times it's white, with powdered cocaine 500 times more. They do not go into the federal system. They remain in the state system where you do not have mandatory minimum sentencing. They get a slap on the wrist, probation 1 year at the most. But powdered cocaine is crack cocaine. They're the same. You cannot separate them. If you had no powder cocaine, you could not have crack cocaine. So we've talked about this in two ways. We want to get rid of it. We're going to work. We're going to do everything that we can. We're going to support a budget. We're going to put it in all of our speeches. We're going to travel across this country. We want education. We want prevention. We want rehabilitation. We've been very clear about that. This administration dare play with us. When their press secretary can tell the press
that they have accepted some recommendations on this issue of fairness and changing to 10 to 1 instead of 100 to 1, and they have consulted with the Congressional Black Caucus, they insult us. They did not consult with us. They did not talk with us. They did not consider our opinion. We have long said we want fairness. We want 1-to-1. We fought the good fight on the floor. We debated this effort ad nauseum on the floor to equalize the sentencing. They disregard us at their own peril. We have stood with this president sometimes when we had questions. We came here and we convened the press and we said we'll stand with him on the race dialogue, even though we had members of this caucus who had serious doubts. We have done everything that we could possibly do to focus this president and this administration on our agenda. While we are Democrats and we work closely with the Democratic administration, we would like to be walking in lockstep with them. We do not want anybody playing with us on our agenda. Drugs is number one on our agenda. President can't play with us. Janet Reno can't play with us. And McCaffrey can't play with us on this issue. They have not consulted with us. They have not sat down with us. We have not been in any serious discussions with them. And so we come with the press conference to say we reject a position that says we can't give you justice, we can't recommend full justice, but we'll recommend a little bit of justice for you. We reject the idea that someone could arbitrarily decide, even despite the Sentencing Commission's recommendation of a 5-to-1, that they have decided to do 10-to-1.
And that is Representative Maxine Waters, who is the chair of the Congressional Black Caucus. Yesterday, the CBC held an angry press conference in response to the latest news that the differential between crack cocaine would be not eliminated, but reduced. Right now, you would get a 5-year mandatory minimum penalty for carrying or selling 5 grams of crack versus 500 grams of powdered cocaine, considered a 100-to-1 ratio, a racial disparity that is putting thousands of African-American men behind bars. The Congressional Black Caucus is rejecting the proposal, which is supported by General Barry McCaffrey, the drug czar, supported by Justice Chief Janet Reno and by President Clinton. Republicans are also opposed to this plan to reduce the differential because they believe it sends the wrong message. Many of them do believe that crack should hold a much stiffer sentence than cocaine. And you're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Just this week, the West Alabama Center Clinic in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, was a victim of arson or a bombing attack. And this is the 13th abortion clinic arson or bombing of this year, the highest rate of anti-abortion violence since 1984. To talk to us briefly about this, we're joined by the Feminist Majority Foundation. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hi.
This is Ana Reyes.
Yes.
Great. Thanks for joining us on Democracy Now! Tell us what happened in Tuscaloosa, Alabama this week.
Well, apparently sometime in the early morning, there was the clinic sustained a fire due to an arson, and it sustained about $100,000 or more worth of damage. The damage would have been much, much greater.
If you'd like to make a call.
The damage would have been much greater, but the fire department was able to get there within minutes to put out the fire.
Ana, has this particular clinic in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, been plagued by threats in the past?
Yes, it has been plagued by threats. To my knowledge, hasn't sustained damage, but it is the 13th clinic this year to sustain damage, and that marks a high increase from last year, and in fact is the highest rate of anti-abortion violence since 1984.
Now that's pretty dramatic statistic there, the highest since 1984 when we were at an all-time high. A lot of these clinic bombings and fires have sort of faded away and gone out of the news. There was some attention recently to the so-called Army of God, a group in the South that was claiming responsibility for a variety of domestic terrorist acts, including attacks on clinics. Why won't the FBI declare these incidences quote-unquote domestic terrorism when in fact they are aimed at frightening women from going to the clinics? It is an act of terror.
Well, they have claimed the Atlanta bombing an act of domestic terrorism. The FBI is looking into the other bombings, whether or not to declare those or this one domestic terrorism. It has not done so yet. I can't hazard a guess as to why. But some of them are being...
They are being declared
right.
That. So what can be done to prevent these attacks from happening? It seems like besides paying close attention to the anti-abortion movement, particularly the violent wing of it, and trying to find out when they might strike, are there things that clinics can do to safeguard themselves?
Well, there are security precautions that clinics can take. The Feminist Majority runs a national clinic access project, and we provide a variety of things, including security consulting for clinics. Also something that I think needs to happen is that this needs to become more prevalent in the press. It hasn't been very widespread that this arson happened or that clinics are being bombed and arsoned left and right in our country, and women's constitutional rights are sort of being done away with in this regard. But the press, I think, needs to help in terms of getting this back into the public limelight. I think a lot of people might not realize how serious of a problem this has become again.
Anna, a lot of these clinics that have been the victims of arson attacks aren't just places where abortions are provided, but they're also places where general women's health care is happening.
Exactly, and those rights, you know, are being sort of done away with also, because women can't go in and sort of get other reproductive health care needs that they might have.
Finally, could you just tell us what states were where the clinics were that were targeted so far this year?
Yes. Oklahoma, Virginia, North Carolina, California, Oregon, Montana, Washington, actually a doctor in New Orleans was stabbed repeatedly in December of 96, so that was at the very end of 96. He was stabbed repeatedly as he was leaving a clinic. And Georgia, of course, the Atlanta bombing.
Right. Anna Reyes, we want to thank you so much for joining us, even briefly, from the Feminist Majority Foundation to alert us to the highest rate of anti-abortion violence that's happened this year, the highest rate since 1984, when the 13th abortion clinic was bombed or attacked by fire just this week in West Alabama, the West Alabama Women's Center Clinic in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. And as you can see, there is no pattern to which states are targeted all over the country. Thanks so much for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Julie Drizin. Our engineer is Andy York. Dan Coughlin is our producer. And join us again tomorrow for highlights from today's campaign finance scandal hearings.